Pixel Burnin explained, using Arduino to detect red light runners, why Twitter is turning away ad money. And Steve Gibson from Security Now says buy postage stamps. All that and more coming up on Tech News Weekly.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Tech News Weekly is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 4, recorded Thursday, October 26th, 2017.
Welcome to the show. This is the place where you get to hear us talk to the people making and breaking the tech news. I'm Megan Maroney.
And I'm Jason Howell. Sometimes breaking the technology, but maybe it isn't their fault that the technology is broken.
Well, maybe. I don't know. Maybe they're just holding it wrong.
That has been known to happen from time to time. I don't know who's at fault here, but we're going to dive into it. Google's new Pixel hardware is starting to magically appear in people's hands, but the experience of a number of reviewers that had early access has given eager Pixel owners pause as quality controls come into question for these devices. Joining us to share his experience with the new Pixel 2 devices is Stephen Hall from 9to5. Google. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So there have been a number of issues that some reviewers have been having, yourself included, pointed to in the reviews. But the biggest issue seems to be that of screen burn-in. At least I feel like of all the kind of quality concerns on these new devices, screen burn-in seems to be the most alarming. You actually experienced this on the device that you've been using. Why don't you first just start off by telling us a little bit about your usage, kind of what you were putting it through and what you saw as a result.
Okay, so this is a pretty complex problem, I'd say. I mean, the Pixel XL 2, the Pixel 2 XL, sorry, is we're finding that it's unfortunately has more problems or more differences, I should say, compared to the smaller Pixel 2 than we would have hoped. But the screen issue is kind of, you can kind of divide it into a few different categories. There's things that we might say are quality control problems. So there might be variance between screens that are coming out of the factory. And then there's some complaints that people have had with the actual color of the display, which in comparison to the typically very vibrant Samsung displays, it looks a little dull to some people. And then there's the burn-in issue, which also might be a quality control issue. We don't really know yet. So far, all Google has said is that they're investigating. I personally, as you can see here on the screen, I had a Pixel that we had used for about a week. It's still not clear kind of what is image retention, which would be, you know, a temporary state of the screen holding on to the image that obviously right here in the image we're showing the navigation bar down here at the bottom. It's hard to tell between the difference of image retention, which is temporary, and an actual burn-in, which is not exactly unheard of with OLED displays. But with the Pixel 2, we're probably just mostly disappointed to be seeing problems with image retention, which itself is not good, but especially not burn-in this early in the game.
Well, so that's what's confusing me. So it's image retention or image persistence, which is temporary, but won't it technically be permanent? I mean, because that image of the home button, that imaginary home button, is there most of the time. So is it, I mean, it's not really temporary at all, right?
Well, so my unit, my first unit, kind of has both problems, it seems like. So whenever I pull up this gray image that will kind of reveal the ghosting that I'm seeing at the bottom of the screen, if I let that image sit there for maybe like, you know, 10, 15 minutes, I start to see that ghosting start to fade, which if this was purely image retention, then if we played, you know, a video for half an hour on the screen and then we popped back over to this gray image, then it should be completely gone in theory if this is image retention, which we have seen on some of LG's TV panels. But I think that it's probably both in my case, which is concerning, obviously, to see this early, because even after I run tests, kind of trying to, you know, so to speak, reset the pixels after 20 or 30 minutes of trying to flash different colors on the screen or play a video. I still am able to see on this first unit I got some ghosting, which would suggest, again, I don't want to jump to conclusions because Google hasn't said anything officially, but that would suggest that there is some amount of actual permanent burn-in happening here.
And you're seeing this when you use that gray image, not necessarily when you're doing other things. Like it's bad right. that it's there at all, but you aren't noticing right. this throughout the rest of your experience.
Right. And like that's a big mode. Point. Yeah, that's a big point to bring up here, not just with this issue, but the blue tint issue we can talk about in a second, is that this is probably not going to be something that normal users will notice. It's right. just kind of, this is an $850 phone, and you know, we're all, I especially, and people have kind of gotten onto me at this for this, I'm looking at it under a microscope, and I really want to know what you're getting, especially when you compare the phone to the smaller Pixel 2, which in theory should be identical, right, in quality.
Right.
So do you think that, I mean, that normal people won't notice this, but the fact that, I mean, it started with review units like yours, and a lot of the early yeah. adopters, the people that, you know, ordered it right away, those aren't normal people. And so in a right. way, is the damage done, or do they just need to get through these first few weeks? And do you think that's why Google hasn't said anything else? Because the more they say, the more it will spread to, you know, non-tech journalists.
The normals.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, well, there's two sides of this argument. I mean, one side of the argument is that, you know, any normal buyer is going to just pick up the Pixel XL for $850, especially someone who's not a tech enthusiast is just going to pick it up, and they might notice. Honestly, I think the blue tint issue is probably the thing that most people would probably notice right out of the gate, because we haven't really seen that on any other comparable phones. Well, we've seen it, but we've never seen it to the degree that we're seeing it. But yeah, I mean, I think that the other side of the you know, so like one side is like this is not that big of a problem and that normal people won't notice it, and the other side is a lot of people, if they're spending $850 on the phone, they're probably going to be the kind of people who really want to, you know, they want to know that what they're getting is a really good quality product. And I think it's fair. You know, we've seen some publications kind of pull their review scores. In a way I can understand that, because they're evaluating the product for buyers, and I think that, you know, last year we were able to say Pixel and Pixel XL, they were the same phone. Only difference was the screen size, mm-hmm. more or less. They had their own little manufacturing issues. We covered them. Other publications covered them. But, you know, everything, all the problems were resolved within a month. Both phones were the same. But now kind of the problem with this generation is that, and this is kind of a bigger problem in my opinion for kind of Google trying to build their brand image, is that the Pixel 2 and the Pixel 2 XL are really not the same phone. I mean, every day we learn about a new, very minor, I'll admit, very minor discrepancy between the two, but a discrepancy nonetheless. Yeah. So I can see like both sides of the argument here.
Yeah, I can understand that as well. Now you're mentioning the blue tint. I will preface this by saying on All About Android on Tuesday, I got very limited time. Florence Ion brought in both devices, so I got, you know, like maybe 5 to 10 minutes of hands on time. But we did take a look, and I did see the bluish tint, especially when you're kind of off axis on it. But I mean, I've used a lot of devices, and I've noticed that off axis kind of view of screens often kind of tilts the color spectrum, you know, reduces the brightness and everything. Do you think that's that a lot of people are going to notice that? Like, I feel like you notice that when you compare it to another screen side by side. But other than enthusiasts, the general person is just going to be like, oh, that's just the screen, whatever.
Oh, yeah, that's definitely possible. I just think my concern, you know, as someone who is looking at these under the microscope, I mean, the LG V30, as some have noted, has a similar panel, most likely coming out of a similar or maybe even the same exact factory. And people have compared them side by side, and seeing the blue tint is normal. It's normal to a degree. All OLED panels, or most OLED panels, you'll see, you know, some kind of off axis discoloration.
Yeah.
But with the Pixel 2 XL, my concern is, one, the smaller Pixel 2 doesn't have this problem. The Pixel 1 and Pixel 1 XL don't have this problem, as far as I can tell, until you get to extreme angles. Whereas the Pixel 2 XL, even unlike the V30, which should have a similar panel, it takes a lot more of a of an extreme off-axis like angle before you notice the blue discoloration. And for the Pixel 2 XL, at least with my units, there could be variants. I'm not sure. Once again, this is another thing we have to wait for Google to find to tell us about. But at least on my units, it's kind of jarring, especially at night, looking at the screen in bed, you know, with lights off. It's pretty jarring whenever you're, you know, you barely tilt the phone and it just kind of goes all blue. Or if you're sitting at your desk and this is a normal use case where you're scrolling through notifications and looking at the phone, it's straight on, it's fine. But, you know, looking at the angle, even sitting at a desk, it looks like completely blue, which is, like I said, not the case with the standard Pixel 2.
Right, right. And obviously, I mean, for those who don't know what's behind these devices, the larger one produced by HTC underneath the smaller one. No, sorry, other way around. Smaller right. one by HTC, larger one by LG. So that can right. explain, you know, some of these differences that we're seeing. We're also hearing about a balance issue between both of the front-facing speakers. Some people are complaining about clicks that are being heard.
Hissing.
My, it just gets worse and worse. I mean, what does this say about Google's kind of quality control, you know, approach to quality control? It really seems like they dropped the ball on this one.
Well, I mean, anyone who's been using Google hardware up to today, I mean, look at the Nexus 5X, the Nexus 6P, all the way back to, you know, even the, you know, the earlier Nexus devices. They've been made by a plethora of different manufacturers. They've all had their problems.
Yeah,
pretty much all of them have had their problems. I mean, we have Nexus 5X, which has boot loop problems. People are they have bricked devices in their drawers because the quality of the hardware is just that poor and just doesn't last that long. Yeah. Nexus 6P has battery problems. So, I mean, really, my thing is not that there are quality control concerns. It's that it's kind of disappointing to see Google, who came out and said last year, these phones are made by Google. We're not going to place the blame. If things go wrong, we're not going to send you to Huawei support, which they did with the Nexus 6P. Last year, they came out and said, these are made by Google. You know, Rick Oshlo comes out on stage and he talks about his philosophy for AI and how hardware is really not that big of a deal and it's really hard to differentiate in hardware. Well, last year, that hardware, the Pixel and the Pixel XL, were, in my opinion, in some ways, higher quality, and it seemed like there was a much closer eye and a much closer attention to detail, making sure that these come out of the factory and into people's hands, you know, working right, and not having these weird design discrepancies. For me, the concern is just it's really disappointing to see, in a way, whereas, you know, the Pixel 2 and Pixel 2 XL are, you know, leaps and bounds ahead of the Pixel 1 in terms of and, you know, performance and stuff. Well, maybe not leaps and bounds, but they're an improvement, right?
Yeah.
It's just important to see. I mean, it's disappointing to me to see that there's these weird quality control problems happening a year later when this year, in my opinion, should have been kind of a refinement of last year, not kind of resurrecting the problems of the Nexus days.
Yeah,
that makes sense.
It really does seem like they've kind of taken a step backward, at least through these early experiences. It's kind of tainted
right.
a little bit, this larger device. And I've seen right. a lot of people online that are just like, I'm canceling my order, or I'm thinking about canceling my order. Thankfully, you get a little bit of a window when you buy through Google directly. So at least you have
right.
that. Maybe get it, see how your device fares, and go from there.
Yeah.
Yes.
Sorry, go ahead.
No, well, I was just going to thank you, but if you have something to add on to that, go for it.
Oh, well, yeah, I was just going to say, like, Google is, you know, they're charging $850 for this device, and they're trying to take on Samsung, which is their own partner, and they're trying to take on Apple with the iPhone 8 Plus. So if they're going to charge $850, I think it's justifiable to say, to compare the devices against the competition, and obviously, according to, you know, those of us that are looking at it under the microscope, the devices are kind of disappointing. But like some have said, as a final note, most people taking these devices out of the box, they're going to love them. I mean, this is just us looking at these devices and looking at these minor problems and trying to pick them apart. But honestly, the Pixel has so many great advantages. I mean, the camera, just the performance of the phones versus every other Android phone on the market, it's just night and day, in my opinion. There's just so many things about this that kind of make them more iPhone-like in terms of, you know, quality and attention to detail on the software side of things and other things like the camera, that I think a lot of people, regardless of these issues, they're going to take these out of the box and they're going to love them. So,
yeah. Yep, and we'll see how far that takes Google with sales this time around. So, Stephen Hall, 9to5google.com. Thank you so much, Stephen. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, thank you.
All right,
have a great night. We'll talk to you soon.
So we got some email. Mm-hmm. We got an email from Chris. He is a new viewer, and he wrote in with some issues with our guest last week, Sarah Walker Becker, and her book, Technically Wrong. Chris writes, tech companies who have to tiptoe around every possible thing that might make a small set of people upset will lose that spark of innovation. Sure, crappy people can use email, Twitter, Facebook, and all their other tech to be crappy people, but that's not a shortcoming of the tech. Please, people use cars as getaway cars when robbing banks and even have used vehicles to run over people, but nobody would suggest we get rid of cars. It's the people that are the problem, not the device. The kerfuffle over the cupcakes strikes me as ludicrous. If you don't like something on your phone, then disable it, uninstall it, or ignore it. We did talk about that a little bit. The cupcake, you couldn't disable it. That was part of her issue. Like, that was just, you know, if it's, there's it's just making, you know, the ability to disable things. That was her point. I would argue that we should all get rid of cars, but that's just me. But thanks for finding us, and thanks for writing us, Chris. And thanks for writing the phrase, the kerfuffle.
Yeah, I love any time anyone can work kerfuffle into the discussion.
Especially with cupcakes. So in December 2015, an Uber driver ran a red light and crashed into a police cruiser, killing one of the passengers, Corey Alacock. Corey's brother has been coding since the fourth grade and says this accident didn't have to happen. Brian Russell Davis is a data science engineer, formerly at Pandora and now the founder of Axiom 88, an engineering first digital agency. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Hey, how you doing?
I'm good. Thanks for coming on. So you are working on a prototype for the dashboard that could tell Uber how often a driver runs a red light. Can you walk us through that a little bit?
Sure. So it's a really simple idea. The idea is that you place a small camera on the dashboard, somewhere on the dashboard. I've been experimenting with all different positions of the camera. And basically what you're doing is you're recording the car as it's going through lights. And with a little bit of machine learning and computer vision and image processing, then you can really understand what the driver's habits are as far as those lights are concerned.
So do you have the prototype, or are you able to show us what you're working on?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard here in the house, but I have...
You don't have a car in your living room? Come on.
Yeah, usually I do, but... this is one of the devices. Obviously, this is not the actual thing, because the actual thing's in the car. But this is an example. I'm not sure if I'm holding it up right.
No, perfect.
It's just a Raspberry Pi. This is the camera. You see how tiny it is. These cameras, when you buy them retail, of course, are expensive, but we've experimented with cameras that are as cheap as $2, and that's still retail price. You can get them even cheaper if, you know, you buy them wholesale or, you know, just get them from China. the other thing I want to show you is going to require a screen share. So should I try that now?
Yeah, sure. If you can hop over, that'd be great.
So the first thing I want to show you probably is the video. So this is a really quick video, a piece of a video of me driving, and you see, it's just showing, kind of like the lights right in the middle of the screen. As I said, I'm experimenting with the position of the camera, and what I did is over here is I just grabbed two frames, one where the light is green and one where the light is red. And, you would probably think, like, okay, this is a really hard problem to solve because, finding this little tiny light for the computer, for a program to find this little tiny light right here, it probably would be really, really hard. Oops, sorry about that. but it's not that hard, actually. So when you think about it, what you need to do, first of all, you're going to use computer vision to figure out where the cars are. So if I use some guides real quick, see if I can pull these down. There we go. So I use some guides real quick to mark out where the tops of the cars are. And then there's going to be a whole lot of white, like blue space above. So, and these lines, we can ignore those. So we can kind of like get to the tops of what would be considered the the power lines. And then we can say within a margin of error that we'll just kind of like focus on the middle, so we can pull those out as well. So then, and you know, I'm just doing this in fireworks right now, but so then we have this really clean like idea of like these were where the lights are. Now I'm going to do another experiment here, and this is using a filter, a real quick filter. And of course, all of this would be done with code.
And that's all happening on the Raspberry Pi in real time?
No. It's not happening in real time.
Okay.
It's going to be, you know, this is not a real time solution right now.
Okay.
This is a solution where it's crunching the numbers, and then it's. I'm not sure if you guys are familiar with TensorFlow. I imagine yes. that you are.
Mm-hmm.
So what it's going to be doing is training a model.
Got it.
So then if I go into this filter, which is for curves, and I'm going to filter for red, it's going to take a second. Okay. And then I'm going to pull this over all the way over here, and you see that the green still shows up. So all I need to do now is for that small little area that I showed you, and if I filter for red, then – find out if there's a green circle inside there. And so the problem is significantly smaller now. Now, just to show you how it works over here, I'm going to cancel this and go over here to the red light. I'm not going to bother with, you know, creating all the guides and the box and stuff like that. But then I'm going to adjust the color here for the curves. Then I'm going to filter for red. I'm going to pull this all the way over here. And then you see that, you know, now, again, the problem is really simple now, because all I have to do is make sure that I don't see those little green dots. And those green dots will show up as image data, which will show up as basically like color data to the computer. And so all the computer has to do is make sure that it doesn't see that in that area. And then what we do is we train the filter, and then we look at the results. We train the filter, look at the results over and over and over again until the algorithm gets better at detecting when a red light or a green light is there.
So you're training it against thinking that the brake lights on the back of the car is the same as a stoplight.
No, it's filtering out the brake lights. So it's not going to see the brake lights. If a brake light is caught in the mix, and this is kind of a harder example because I'm really far away. You can imagine it will be easier actually when I'm somewhere like here. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a little out of focus. So now, it's easier because this is like right smack in the middle. And then if this is a red light, or if in other words, there's another example that I had here. If this is a red light, then I know that I've ran a red light. Here, I went through a yellow light,
mm-hmm.
and there was no red, and then it was green right here. I actually ran this yellow light. See that?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't in the intersection yet, and then. But it was yellow the whole entire time. So this is not an instant like, okay, give an alert kind of thing. It's a thing where, first of all, we'll be tracking information, you know, over time to see the driving patterns of people's driving.
Of individual Uber drivers to know right. whether they are inclined to run a red light. Or to right. kind of obey these signals. So eventually something like this would be happening in real time.
Maybe I imagine that it could.
Potentially yes, it could be integrated into the Uber technology. Uber has a lot of very knowledgeable, you know, and very, talented engineers, let's say. Why do you think they haven't implemented something like this already? Because it seems pretty valuable to their fleet.
You know, I think it's valuable in a different way. I think right now they're focused so much on, and you know, I don't want to say too many. I mean, obviously my brother died, you know, I could be very upset about that, but I think, you know, it's been 2 years now and I'm trying to like, you know, be very positive. I think that they're focused a lot on growth and you know, expanding, you know, the amount of drivers and expanding the amount of riders and a lot of the resources to get put into that. Safety probably doesn't get as much attention. And what I'm trying to show with this is that actually there's a lot of easy fixes for safety that would make that can make an exponential difference over time. So that's one of them. You could also, in my article that I wrote, you can also monitor their speed, which is really easy with the accelerometer. You can also limit the amount of, this is one that can be implemented immediately. You can limit the amount of time that an Uber driver can drive. So in my brother's case, the driver, you know, I think was 73 years old. And we know for a fact that, you know, as you get older, your reaction time and, you know, as far as driving is concerned, can be compromised. And over time, also with driving a long amount of hours, your reaction time can be compromised. Mm-hmm. So the thought here is that, number one, limit the amount of time that drivers can drive continuously. I know during the holidays that a lot of drivers will try to, like, you know, get bonuses and, you know, they're trying to get, you know, more money in order to buy gifts for their family, that kind of thing. But there's a certain point to where you're driving unsafe. And so that should be a really easy thing. You know, after a certain amount of hours, I'm not sure what that amount is for each company. But I know for me, if I drive for 10 hours, then I'm pretty, you know, baked. Yeah. But also maybe that there is a simple visual test that can be done for all the drivers and especially older drivers that will kind of test their reaction time to see, you know, if they're still within the safe limit of reaction time. Because really, you know, a few more seconds of reaction time would have probably saved my brother's life.
It's amazing to me that they're not doing that, especially the hours. I mean, I know truck drivers are only allowed to drive certain hours, but
right.
But yeah. I think it's a good point that they are very focused on growth. So this is kind of a family project that you're working on. Your son has a project that's different, but you're using that. Can you talk a little bit about how those two have come together?
Yeah, I'm so proud of my son. He's a senior at Morehouse College in Atlanta, Georgia. He's a math major. Ever since his freshman year, he's had an internship at Rockwell. So he's going to come out of college with a job in mechanical engineering. And about a year ago, I asked him, I said, hey, have you invented anything lately? And he said, well, yeah, I've invented this optical switch. And I was like, oh, this is cool. So I had a friend who was a nuclear scientist. Don't ask. That's a long story. But him and Caleb got together and devised the simple device that can detect gamma radiation. So it's just, you know, a switch is just kind of like, you know, it's telling if something is off or on. And the optical part of it is what makes it so cheap, is because basically it's just light. And so Caleb would have to explain it, but basically all it does is it detects whether or not that light has been split by a particle of gamma radiation. And he presented this at the American Nuclear Society conference in Vegas. It was also around the time of his birthday, so that was kind of perfect timing. And a lot of people were impressed by it. It was really great.
I'm curious to know how you feel. I mean, I feel like the story around Uber often kind of ventures into the story, this like growing trend towards autonomous vehicles.
Yeah.
And what you're talking about, the technology that you've been working on, is really geared towards actual human drivers and not, you know, not machines, not robots driving the cars. Does this shift towards autonomous fleets, does that give you hope for the future of auto safety compared to kind of what we've grown accustomed to, what we're used to now?
Right. So when you think about it, the autonomous fleet already has this technology.
Right.
It already has to sense a red light. So all I'm asking is that we miniaturize and that some of that technology and make it available for for regular drivers. But yes, the autonomous cars already have a technology built in, and I'm sure there will be, you know, they're testing it to make sure that, you know, they save people's lives, don't endanger anyone's lives there. And I guess what I'm saying is that it's kind of the opposite. It's that the technology that's being kind of sunk into this autonomous model should be also kind of retroactively looking at people who are actually driving really real cars.
Right. And if it's a Raspberry Pi and, you know, a $2 camera, it's something that's affordable. It's not crazy expensive technology either.
Right. I mean, and think about it, like, you know, you can mount your phone on your right in front of your dash. And so maybe that's part of it as well. You don't even have to buy a new camera. You can use the camera that's right there on your phone.
Yeah, good point.
Well, Brian, thank you so much for joining us. Brian Russell Davis is a full stack dev engineer with 17 years of experience. And tell us a little bit about Axiom 88. That's the company that you founded. What do you guys do?
Oh, sure. Yeah. We do a lot of stuff, mostly these days, on data science type stuff. So I've done a lot of work for military intelligence and analyzing threat data. I worked in something called ArcLive, which is basically like a Jason Bourne Google traffic maps for like terrorist threats. You know, also I've built apps and stuff like that and websites. So it doesn't have to be, you know, that scary.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. Take care.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah. Best of luck with your project.
Bye-bye.
Appreciate it.
So in my youth, yes. Jason, I was taught not to fear the Reaper, but maybe it is time that I did, especially considering the amount of IoT devices I have running in my house right now. Joining us to talk about the sneaky botnet that already infected millions of networks is Steve Gibson from GRC and Security Now. Welcome to the show, Steve.
Hey, guys. Great to be with you this
afternoon. Good to see you, Steve.
So what is Reaper? Is it Halloween hype or is it something that I ought to really be scared of?
Well, I don't know that you should be scared of it, although it could create a problem for the internet. It's been a few days more than 1 year since the Mirai botnet was found to be responsible for creating a huge internet disruption by using its 100,000 IoT devices, largely cameras and digital video recorders. It used those to attack a major DNS provider, Dyn DNS. And by holding that DNS provider off of the internet through a distributed denial of service attack for many hours, the DNS information, that the mapping between domain names and IP addresses, had a chance to drain out of the where it was cached by other DNS servers, and they were unable to refresh the information from the master Dyn DNS server. So all over the world, people stopped being able to reach websites which were users of Dyn DNS. That was just over a year ago. We're almost at the anniversary. Well, we're just past the anniversary. That was 100,000 connected internet connected devices. This new net, which was first detected by two different security firms a week ago, is known by different names because they each gave it their own name. One is IoT Reaper and the other is IoTroop, IoTROOP. Today, that botnet is more than 2 million devices.
Wow.
So a year ago, Mirai, with 100,000, was able to push Dyn DNS off the net and cause unreachability globally for websites that relied on Dyn DNS's services. This network is 20 times bigger now and is growing at 10,000 new devices per day. It has more potential growth because the Mirai botnet a year ago was guessing simple administrative logons, which were exposed by cameras and DVRs, and also trying the default passwords. This new network is actively exploiting previously known defects that have never been patched. Some as many as 4 years old. And these exist in D-Link, Netgear, Linksys, other popular routers, in several cameras, in one flavor of DVR. And there's also been attacks against Synology, NAS, and Linux servers. So this thing is very aggressive. In one case, when a new defect appeared on October 8th, just this recent October 8th, that the knowledge of that defect was incorporated into the botnet within 2 days. So whoever is behind this, and no one knows who's behind it, they are actively watching the industry. They are incorporating the latest knowledge of defects, and this thing is growing hugely. It incorporates it has been captured and reverse engineered, and there are more than 100 open DNS servers known to it. That is, in its code, it appears to be prepared to launch probably the most powerful, massive denial of service attack we have ever experienced, because you're able to send a query to a DNS server pretending to come from somewhere else. And so the DNS server's response, which is larger than the query you sent out, goes to that other location. It's called the DNS amplification attack, because a little bit of bandwidth in the query is amplified into a larger response, which you're able then to spoof your IP and cause to go to another destination. This botnet that is 2 million already, 20 times the size of Mirai and growing rapidly, is set to do something. It hasn't done anything. No one knows what it's going to do. But, I mean, this is the most potent weapon that has yet been assembled. And so something's going to happen. We don't know what.
Making me really nervous, Steve. So we have the benefit of if it's any sort of benefit at all, of knowing this ahead of time. Does that give – I mean, is there any hope that there will be measures as a result of this knowledge to help soften the blow, or is this just bigger than all that?
I'm not in the loop to know what might be going on behind the scenes. Certainly, it's gotten a lot of press. You would imagine that people at the Department of Homeland Security in the U.S. and maybe elsewhere are getting engaged, because the picture I've painted is one that is understood. That is the fact that this is 20 times bigger than Mirai, which nuked a major DNS provider long enough to cause global outages for specific websites. So this has to be at someone's attention. The way to intercept this is to get to its command and control. That is, that somewhere these 2 million bots are going to some knowable servers to get instructions. Yet the author of this apparently is very sophisticated. This botnet is growing so fast, he or she or they are adding new command and control systems, because it's so big it needs more command and control just in order to manage the scale of this thing. So I don't know whether they'll be able to neuter it before it does something. I would imagine they're being careful, because if they start to neuter it and the person in control notices that he's beginning to lose some access, that might cause him to launch an attack. So, I mean, it's a potent weapon, which is now living in I believe it was 60% of enterprises in the U.S. have equipment which this thing has infected. So at the moment, it's only being used, we presume, for attacking other things on the internet. But it means that every single enterprise where – and apparently it's 60% of them – actually are compromised And so that infection could turn around and look into their network rather than just being used to blast data back out onto the public internet. I mean, this is the big problem with the so-called Internet of Things devices. We're all used to now having our apps updated and our phones updated. I mean, and Windows 10, my God, that's a drama every time it updates. So the notion of constant updates is already filtered into the fabric of the way we operate with our PCs and our mobile devices. But it hasn't gotten there with light bulbs and refrigerators and you know, routers. Yeah, yes, you can check for a firmware update, but it just doesn't do it by itself. Normally, it's something you have to go do. So as a consequence, there's hundreds of millions of devices with known vulnerabilities not being patched that are just ripe for this kind of remote takeover. And now we're seeing these chickens coming home to roost.
So the Checkpoint website has a list of the devices that you can check to see if you have one. So I expected to see like, oh, you know, the Amazon Echo or, you know, the Hue Lights Hub. But they're all, I mean, they're not like IoT devices, right? I mean, the list, it's like the Synology system that you were talking about, Linksys routers. It doesn't seem that long of a list, really. I mean, what should home users, is there anything to look at, or is the real problem coming from the enterprise?
In every case, the vulnerabilities that are being exploited are known and have been patched. That is, the patches are available, but nobody, those victims are not patching. So The absolute takeaway advice is, if you keep your stuff current, if you go check your router's at admin page and click on the check for update, and if it says there's one available, update it. If there says no, you're current, you're fine, because this thing is taking advantage of known, publicly known, previously fixed problems. It's just that I imagine listeners of this podcast and my Security Now podcast, you know, we're probably all current, but we're not everybody.
So you've mentioned the level of sophistication here, and obviously the scale of it is something that we haven't seen. Do you think that points to the possibility of this being the workings of like a nation state or something, some big effort like that?
I don't think so. I could do this if I wanted to, and I'm not a nation state. There are a lot of smart guys out there and girls who could do this. It's just, I mean, there is this sort of this weird thing where for all these decades we had viruses, and they never, until recently when we had crypto malware happen. But, you know, that's after 20 years of viruses. They just sort of lived to infect things and to infect other things. They didn't really seem to be doing much damage. And similarly, this kind of technology, I mean, the capability to do this is longstanding. It's just no one has. Well, until now.
Mm-hmm. Well,
So it takes the proper engineering, but it doesn't take genius or huge dollars. I mean, you know, someone in their basement could be in control of this and could have just whittled it away, you know, genned it up last weekend.
So Brian Krebs calls this the calm before the storm, and Checkpoint says this is a cyber hurricane, and you described it sort of like it's gathering up. Is it time for us to evacuate? Do we just air gap everything?
Just maybe get postage stamps.
Okay. Okay. Postage stamps. Good advice. Steve, thank you so much. As always, it is a kind of pleasure talking to you. A very specific pleasure talking to you.
That's right. Steve, fasten your seatbelt.
Steve Gibson, of course, the creator of SpinRight and Shields Up, and the host of Security Now on the Twit Network, which you can subscribe to at twit.tv/SN. Thank you so much for joining us, Steve.
Thanks, guys. My pleasure.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Have a good
All right. The ongoing look into the scope of Russian interference in the 2016 election has put a number of major tech companies under the microscope. We've heard about this for months now, and many are changing the way that they operate as a result of the related discoveries. Joining us to talk about the twists and turns of Twitter in light of these investigations is Kurt Wagner from Recode. Welcome, Kurt.
Hey, guys. How you doing?
Good. It's great to see you. It's been a while.
It has. It's good to be back.
Good to have you back. So Twitter is facing scrutiny, not only from Robert Mueller's probe, but also from the House Intelligence Committee, the Senate Intelligence Committee, the Senate Judiciary Committee, lots of committees in there. What kinds of discoveries have come out of all of that scrutiny in the recent months that's affecting Twitter right now?
Yeah, so what we know about Twitter is that there was kind of a bot network that was, you know, these accounts were linked to Russian sources, I guess, and they were spreading misinformation through this bot network. And then there was also these kind of Russian-sponsored publications that were paying for ads and promoting them on Twitter as well. And so much like Facebook and Google, Twitter kind of came to this realization, obviously much later after the fact, after the election, that all of this was going on. They're going to be testifying next week along with Facebook and Google in front of all those committees that you mentioned. And so what they're trying to do is kind of get ahead of that. And so they're are announced, I'm trying to think, was it 2 days ago, I guess, a couple of changes to their ad platform and how they're going to kind of disclose all of the ads that are running on Twitter, especially political ads. Facebook has kind of announced it's going to do something a little bit similar. And so what you're seeing is these companies trying to basically say, hey, look, we're going to self-regulate our own advertising. You know, the government, you guys don't have to do this, even though you want to do this. Look, we're going to do it on our own. And they're trying to get a lot of this in place before they go to D.C. next week so that they have something to, you know, hold up and show all these members of Congress who are going to be grilling them.
Time and time again, between Facebook and Twitter, especially, you hear, you know, bots kind of come into the conversation when it comes to kind of this influencing, this propaganda effort. You know, bots are very, very involved. Bots are a big part of these platforms. Wasn't it just 2 years ago that bots were all the rage and everybody was talking about how this is the next thing to get really excited about in technology? Yet with that comes a lot of power, obviously, and the potential of influence. How much of a hand do you think bots have had in this particular influence or interference? And I mean, is there any kind of reality for Twitter, for Facebook to just like get rid of bots to feel like that's the only solution here? I realize it's not, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, it's a little bit tough to quantify, right? Which is what makes this whole thing really interesting is that you can say, hey, look, this much was spent on ads, or there were this many bots that, you know, Twitter found that were linked to Russia. But really, it's hard to quantify what kind of an influence that might have had on, say, your average voter in Michigan, right, or in Ohio. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really what the challenge is Facebook has these big numbers, right? It comes out and says, hey, there was $100,000 spent on ads. And for the average person who maybe doesn't understand digital advertising, $100,000 feels like a lot of money. Obviously, to Facebook, it's not a huge amount, but you know, and it says, hey, this content could have reached 10 million people. Again, what does that really mean? We just don't really know. So I think the bot thing plays a big role in the sense that Twitter has pointed to bots and Facebook has also pointed to what it calls inauthentic accounts, basically accounts that aren't, you know, tied to a real life human being who's using their true identity, or a real life business that's using its true identity. So clearly there was, you know, these quote unquote fake or bot accounts that were set up. But I think, you know, while Facebook has always been about trying to remove that kind of stuff and saying, hey, we want everyone to use their true identity here, Twitter has kind of let bots be a part of the platform, right? Like there are, in theory, good bots that retweet, you know, certain, you know, presidents, I guess, right? Or, hey, every time Donald Trump likes a tweet, there is a bot that will, you know, tweet that tweet out and say, hey, President Trump just liked this tweet. And people get value from that. So I personally think the value isn't as great as, you know, the risk, so to speak. So I think for someone like Twitter to go in and kind of purge its site of bots seems like a pretty good idea to me. But I think it's also there's a little bit more of a history there than there would be like a Facebook or someone else.
So Twitter said that they were estimating to make $1.9 million. That's what they projected from global advertising just from RT. And they, you know, they said, we're giving that up. And, you know, you've followed Twitter for a long time. And they've said this at the same time that they're now being forced to talk to Congress about it. Do you think really that they, do you think they had any idea what was going on? What do you think they knew about how much RT was trying to influence or not influence? How much do you think they knew before?
Man, I'm a little afraid to speculate just because I don't know. What I can guess and what came out this morning, you mentioned the RT thing. I mean, RT came out and showed these pictures of a slide deck, right, that Twitter supposedly pitched them and said, hey, we want you to come advertise on Twitter. Here are the benefits of doing so. So it seems very clear that it's not as if they didn't know RT or Sputnik were spending money on the platform. The question is, did they realize that, you know, there was the connection to the Russian government and extended beyond that? Was there a actual motive here to try and influence the election? I would hope, of course, that Twitter did not know that, right? Like, if Twitter knew that this was happening and was still encouraging this company to spend a small amount. I mean, $1.9 million, that's, I think, since, 2011 or something I read. I could be wrong, but, like, that is over many years. Mm-hmm. That is not significant revenue for Twitter. So for it to, like, jeopardize its whole reputation by knowingly encourage someone to influence the election, I think would be crazy. So my hunch is that they didn't know, but they certainly knew that there were advertising dollars being spent. And so it'll be very interesting for them to kind of explain either why they didn't know RT had this relationship with the government, or if they did know that, you know, what was the impetus behind kind of pushing them to spend money.
Maybe it's innocent thinking of me, but I just kind of feel like it's a case of naivete on Twitter's part, on Facebook's part, although they have a lot of people that make a lot of money to know and understand this stuff on the back end. So if they didn't know that stuff early on, then that says something else entirely about how they run their business.
And it just feels like such a risk for such a small reward, right?
Yeah.
Like, if you knew that there was this manipulation going on, the amount of money, I think it was $275,000 that was spent kind of during the campaign. It's just such a small amount for a company of Twitter size to, again, justify like taking this kind of a risk. So, but then, as you pointed out, then it becomes what? So you're either, you know, evil or you're incompetent, right?
Right.
And in this case, I'm with you. I don't think there was malicious evil going on, but okay, so that only leaves one other option. Yeah.
Well, I think the other option is what they always say is this is free speech. Like, we don't want to control what people can advertise and what they can't. That sort of thing. I mean, that's always their excuse, right?
Exactly. But the fact that they came out and decided today that, hey, we're not going to allow this publication to buy ads anymore shows me that they've decided that free speech thing isn't, you know, necessarily, it crosses some kind of line for them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So if they're willing to decide now, today, after the election, that RT is no longer allowed to buy ads on Twitter, what's different? I mean, obviously, I guess what's different is that we publicly know about this, connection between RT and these Russian sources. So then the question becomes, why wasn't that known a year ago?
Well, I think it echoes a lot of their decisions lately that are really just like they held so tight to that. Like, people can say they can be anonymous, they can say whatever they want. They held so tight to that for so long that now that they're moving the line, like, no one knows where it is. You know, it's everywhere. Like,
totally.
Is this person going to be banned? Is this, you know, is this allowed? Is that allowed? And like, who's making those decisions? It's just, it's better than not making any of these decisions, but it's unsettling, I think.
Well, it's tough when you're making it on a case-by-case basis because it's really hard to be consistent, right? And how do you treat a celebrity user who's abused and harassed versus your kind of everyday user who has 50 followers? Like, does the fact that someone has a million followers make them, you know, more important to act on than the 50-follower user? Those are the kinds of things that, you know, you oftentimes see with a company like Twitter. And it just makes it really when it's not super consistent, and when they refuse to kind of talk about individual accounts and kind of explain, hey, here's why we're taking action here, or here's why we're not, it just makes it really hard for someone on the outside to appreciate or understand really the challenge that they're going through. And again, the consistency, I don't think, has been there. And that's the big issue.
And then how is this translating into how Twitter is doing as a company, or just in general, how they've been operating their business? I know there was an earnings report today. Is this kind of Russian ads scrutiny affecting Twitter at all on Wall Street?
I don't think so. It doesn't seem to be affecting any of the companies on Wall Street, at least right now. I think the biggest concern would be if government comes out and creates all of these really strict regulations, could that impact their advertising business a year from now or 2 or 3 years from now? I think that is more the concern. I think today, right now, I mean, Twitter, as you mentioned, they had earnings this morning. Their revenue was right in line with what Wall Street expected. Their user growth was pretty much right in line with what Wall Street expected. They didn't even mention Russia on the call, as far as I remember, although it was like 5 a.m. Pacific time, so I could have been a little bit sleepy. But, you know, I didn't hear a single question about that unless I missed it. So it doesn't seem to be impacting the business or the stock price of these companies right now. But again, I think it all depends on is this going to become a more tightly regulated industry moving forward? And if so, I think that's when you're going to see some concern from investors.
Yeah, and that's what you know, could possibly be kicking off as they go into next week's kind of public testimony. And yeah, it's all it feels like it's all kind of coming to a head right now. There's a lot of change in the air for just big tech in general, and this is a big part of that.
Yeah, I mean, next week will be fun. Well, as fun as like
fun.
You know, yeah, government regulation conversation can be, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. Kurt Wagner from Recode.net. Kurt, it was great having you on again. Where can people follow all your work online?
Yeah, you can go to Recode.net. That's where all my work is and my colleagues. And then I'm on Twitter at Kurt Wagner 8.
Right on. Thanks again, Kurt. We really appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Have
Take
a great
care.
Night. All right, and finally, if you fancy yourself a sports ball person, then you might be tuning into the World Series to see the LA Dodgers taking on the Houston Astros, and you might also find yourself perplexed by the YouTube button that's been hovering over the center of the image on your TV set while watching. No, that's not a web video player on your TV set. That's brilliant advertising, in my opinion, on the part of YouTube, who placed an ad for YouTube TV right behind home base, perfectly placed so that when the shot shows the pitcher pitching to the batter, the play button just kind of appears almost where it would normally appear on the players on YouTube's site, which can be very distracting if you've used YouTube a lot. I think just in this day and age, we're so used to web video players, and especially YouTube, since YouTube is the dominant web video player of all time. So when you see, I mean, it's just such an iconic, you know, symbol to be in the middle of the screen. So it's almost like it's hard to focus on the game itself because mm-hmm. you keep thinking you need to press play to watch it.
Right. It was hard for me to focus right now. I wanted to press play. I wanted to click on play there. Yeah. It's the most exciting thing about the World Series.
Oh, really?
Yes. And I grew up in Houston watching the Astros. So.
Okay. Well, there you go. Tons of complaints, though, from people on Twitter that are just like, why do they do that? I think it's brilliant. Like, I don't know. But then at the same time, the whole Burger King Google Home thing happened. And I think I was kind of, no, I didn't think that was quite as brilliant, mm-hmm. Only more annoying than anything. So I guess it depends on who you ask. But I don't know. Maybe I like baseball viewers to be trolled a little bit. Mm. Maybe that's it. Mm-hmm. I have a hard time watching baseball, I guess. That's me. That's not you.
Yeah.
And I apologize.
No, we are both allergic to cats and we hate baseball. So that.
And Burke also.
Is allergic to cats. And yes.
We've got a lot of allergies on this show. Tech News Weekly records live every Thursday at 2:30 p.m. Pacific. You can be part of the show by emailing us. All you have to do is send that email to tnw@twit.tv and we'll throw it in the show.
And subscribe to our show. Go to twit.tv/TNW. And if you want to tweet at me about how much you love baseball and how wrong I am about not liking it, I am at Megan Maroney.
And I'm at Jason Howell on Twitter. Thanks to Josh, our TD and editor for the day. Thanks to Bert for helping out in the studio. Thanks to Jammer B and Colleen for helping as well. And thanks to you, because it's always great to have you along. We'll see y'all next week on another episode of Tech News Weekly. See you guys.